Chapter 3. Winkle. The rock pool had acquired a slightly ambiguous amphibian identity. I had made it, but it was making itself, a micro-Arcadia, a self-creating fragment, the opposite of one of Jean Tinguely's famous self-destroying machines that tore themselves apart in a juddering frenzy, conducting a war on their own bodies until they lay in ruins around themselves, the remains of a party to celebrate their own dying. The pool would run that film in reverse, a self-gathering organism, a self-enriching thing, with the layers of significance and connection building in it over the weeks and months, and in that way turning into a model of the growth of life itself. In the world at large, a huge diminution is underway. In the seas and on the shores around Scotland, damage has been done and will continue to be done. But here, in the smallest of gestures, something could perhaps turn the other way. All kinds of ideas came clustering in. The pool seemed, in fact, to generate associations and implications. First, from reading some essays by Tim Robinson, the writer, cartographer and mathematician, who mapped and wrote about wild and treasured landscapes on the far western edge of Ireland. He was an outsider to those places, and had gone to the Isles of Arran in 1972, working as an artist, but with a background in mathematics at Cambridge, and a sense that on that far western edge of Europe he might find his life's work. The maps he made were subtle, exact, speckly, light-veined things, as precise as a leaf. He walked every yard of every lane and boreen he could find, tracing as far as he could every stretch of cliff and shore, marking not only the changes since the Ordnance Survey made their maps in the early 20th century, but adding the Irish names and the hidden valuable places, the sacred stones and wells, the secret corners, the overgrown paths and causeways, which had not mattered to the British surveyors, but were the grain and weft of the place for the people who had always lived there. Partly through this close and repetitive attention to the country, and partly through his training in mathematics, Robinson came to realise that our relationship to anywhere in the world, and above all to a coastline, is governed by one particular aspect of its geometry, its fractals. He had been alerted by a short paper published in Science in 1967, written by the American mathematician Benoit Mandelbrot. "How long is the coast of Britain?" Mandelbrot had asked, drawing on the work of the English geographer and meteorologist Lewis Richardson, a specialist in the measurement of turbulent phenomena. Richardson, in the 1930s, had established the strange and counterintuitive fact that the length of any irregular line, a coast, a path, a fallen thread, the outline of an eruptive cloud, expands or contracts according to the scale at which you measure it. Use a large, coarse-grained ruler, and you will get a rough, and short, idea of its length. Use a micrometer, and the line will begin to stretch towards infinity. Mandelbrot systematized Richardson's empirical observations and proved, as Robinson wrote, that when mapping a coastline, the idea that one gets a better and better approximation to its length by measuring it in finer and finer detail is false. The series of approximations does not converge to an answer. It just gets bigger and bigger. Mandelbrot gave the name fractal to these infinitely lengthening lines, from the Latin fractus, meaning broken or irregular, and in doing that created a new realm of mathematics and geometry which stepped beyond the standard Euclidean certainties but could be applied to all sorts of phenomena in nature. The concepts of point, line and plane, the primary elements in school geometry, work for ideas or conceptual forms, but not for the wriggled, convoluted shapes of reality. Euclidean certainties cannot describe the swirl of water into a hollow, or the plume of a volcano, or any kind of turbulence, a flowing stream, the branch pattern of lightning, the growth of trees or corals, the alveoli of the lungs, the wrinkles in skin, the shape of a shore, or the growing and ebbing of grief or love. This unmeasurability means that the Mandelbrot world is a set of dizzying spirals. The closer you look, the deeper it dives. Any examination of anything becomes an ever-growing, ever-inward plunge into the indefinable. The slower you go, the more there is to your journey. Pause for a moment and a place will pool out around you, not as an illusion, but as a fact. In details it would not have had if you had not stopped to look. This means that in the real world, outside the classroom shapes of a straight line or a perfect sphere, nothing is measurable. For every inch on a straight line, there is indeed a single inch. But most shapes in nature are longer than you imagine. The place itself becomes the only possible measurement of what it is. Seamus Heaney wrote of The People of the Sea, David Thompson's beautiful exploration of the place of the seal in the imagination of the Scottish and Irish margins of the Atlantic, that his book was luminously its own thing. That is true of the shore itself. It is its own book, the only full account of itself, its own luminosity. Its existence is the only true light it has. Robinson had first been drawn to mapping the coast of Connemara because of its strange geography, like a rope of closely interwoven strands, flung down in twists and coils across an otherwise bare surface. But Richardson and Mandelbrot had shown that picture to be false. You could never straighten the rope. However taut you pulled it, more twists would emerge. A coastline would be equally wriggly if you examined it at the scale of a continent, a rock pool, a sand grain, or an atom. Like all discoveries, Robinson wrote, Mandelbrot's realization surprises us yet again with the unfathomable depth and texture of the natural world. Specifically, it shows that there is more space, more places on a seashore, within a forest or among the galaxies, than the geometry of common sense allows. Vertigo comes with that. Reality must outstretch any understanding of it, and as Mandelbrot wrote, coastline length turns out to be an elusive notion that slips between the fingers of those who want to grasp it. The fractal is a kind of mind cuckoo. I was wanting in my rock pool to see in detail the reality of things. The fractal pushes aside any hope of certainty, and once that doubt has taken up residence, it cannot be dislodged. Everything succumbs. Fractals are everywhere, in the way that winds blow, each gust a curved outgrowth of the trend, each gust within a gust mimicking the wind structure that folds out across oceans and continents, or the way a river will run past a rock or tree root and twist into spirals beyond it, or in waves breaking on a beach, even in the way natural populations develop, or markets shift, or the boundaries of growing cities push out into the surrounding country, in the shape and formation of the universe. Look at an image of the surface of the sun, and it boils with infolded possibility, turning in all three dimensions, inhaling as much as dilating, a dance of nuclear, magnetic and gravitational flux, spirals at the source of everything we can see. This turbulence is embedded in the workings of the physical world, and not only the physical. Allow your mind to wander in its thinking, and ideas do not follow in a predictable, clarified, linear Euclidean path, but bubble up like this, within themselves, emerging as the children of the ideas that preceded them, growing within the wombs of those parents, and then becoming parents themselves of the ideas that succeed them, a rippling involution and evolution of successive and successively nested thoughts. As if the mind were a breaking wave or a river disrupted by the bed in which it ran. Every atom belonging to me, as good belongs to you, Whitman said, and that is a fractal recognition, the cupping of reality in successive layers of itself. The shore is filled with infinite regressions from ocean to channel, to bay to pool, to bay within the pool, to an inlet in that bay, to a micro-pool, an inlet within it, and so on and on into the microscopic. The whole sequence is a frozen, or in fact exceptionally slow, kind of fractal turbulence, the sea imposing on the land, a form of shaping which, if taken away from our own time perspective and given its planetary due, would bubble and break, in time as well as in space, an endless overturning of the substance of the world. To make a rock pool was, in fact, to make something no less complex than the ocean itself. But here is the dizzying part. Fractal theory suggests that the closer you look at something, the more it remains unknown. Knowledge cannot embrace whatever it seeks to know. It can only sit alongside the world, contingent, touching it, maybe, at one or two points, but shrinking beside the undressable and limitless actuality of things. One of the applications of the theory, as Tim Robinson wrote, is to estimate the number of habitable niches available to creatures of different sizes on a given surface. Here a small area of shore, say an acre, when examined in detail discloses a huge variety of holes and crevices of a total surface area hundreds of times greater than of the acre, and within those holes and clefts are smaller ones, sheltering smaller creatures, who enjoy areas hugely greater still, and so on, to the well-nigh infinitesimal, the single-celled. The rock pool was not going to be a tiny, graspable fragment of the universe. It was going to be as unknowable as the universe itself. This is one of the oldest of conundrums. Plato knew it. May a man not possess, and yet not have, knowledge? Socrates asked in his usual taunting way. The question was not whether a man may have the knowledge, which is obvious enough, we all know things, but whether the knowledge can have the thing it knows. The habitual Socratic interrogative is a fractal form, doing no more than revealing the questions within his questions, as if the world were a series of Chinese boxes, each one labelled uncertainty. Suppose someone has caught some wild birds, Socrates asked, doves or any other birds, and is keeping them in an aviary which he has made at home. We can say of him, in one sense, that he has them, because he possesses them, might we not? And yet, in another sense, he has none of them. It is the most subversive picture of knowledge. Look at a wild creature, even hold it in your hand, and it is obvious that you do not have it. You hold it, but everything it is stretches far beyond your enclosing fingers, in time and space and through its own interior existence. You may possess it, even for a moment, but it is not yours. Plato's understanding was to see knowledge in the same way. Whatever it is that is to be known remains outside the grip of our knowing it. The knowledge can scarcely embrace the irredeemably wild and unconstrained facts it hopes to know. We might make an aviary of our ideas, but the birds we shut inside it have their life and being far beyond its walls. When I first heard the story of Socrates' aviary, which is the nub of Socratic wisdom, the acknowledgement that fractal depths lie within any known or measured surface, I whooped with the pleasure of recognition. It confirmed everything I had been instinctively feeling about the pool. What is a tidal pool but a cage, an aviary with permeable walls? A volunteer zoo into which life will come if the conditions are congenial, but leave when the tide floods and the walls become irrelevant. Not a place that preserves what is already there, but a frame to encourage the assembling of life, in whose linkages and interstices the functions of life might find a home. Nothing in it would be mine. Its boundaries would be both open and closed, alternating with the tides twice a day, breathing like that, drawing organisms in, holding them, releasing them, depending on the sea to give it life. Making the pool was a kind of gardening, but one in which the gardener merely built the enclosure, or a half-enclosure, an enclosure that twice a day melted and dissolved, only to reappear as the tide dropped and brought no plants and weeded no weeds. It represented a curiously true relationship to the natural. Making it would be a human act, but with a natural outcome. It could both enclose and fail to enclose. Its fractal spirals could spin off into the sea itself. It would be a model of Socrates's aviary, and in that inadequacy, the explicit transience of its containment, would be a kind of perfection. Perfect because imperfect. April came. The grass was still as brown and low as ever. The sycamores were just coming into leaf, or some of them. Individual limbs of particular trees were fronded green, others still in winter. Different parts of one branch were in different seasons. The spears of the flag irises were up in the marsh above the shore, no flowers yet, but under the trees, celandines and big pansy-sized violets were scattered in the grass. Wild strawberries and primroses flowered at the foot of the trees where the trunks curved out in little buttressed hollows towards their roots. The first pair of house martins had arrived. Their nest was tucked up under the barge boards at the west end of the house. Every minute of the day they flew up to the eaves and out again, from life to nest and nest to life. They sometimes picked bugs from the strand line, perhaps quick enough to catch an orchestia, then flew in low over the grasses, scarcely avoiding the bright points of the irises, before cutting and slanting in among the trees, thread-weaving past the trunks. I made a map of the pool. The prawns were in evidence, but otherwise it was in the same planetary condition as when I had dug it. Photographs underwater looked like a scene on Mars, a stone universe with mineral shards of this and that lying there. Some disconnected bits of wrack had floated in on the tide. There was nothing growing except a few filaments of bright green gutweed. Close up it looks like a string of neon sausages. But that is not a good sign. Gutweed likes fresh or brackish water, which means the salinity of this pool was not high. The saltiness of the sea, probably overwhelmed by the rain that had fallen into it. Nothing had failed here yet because nothing had happened. The pool was full of sand and sticks, a leaf or two from the trees, the shell of two dead crabs, gone white and orange, their ghost bodies dusted with the sand. It is what the sea would be when life had come to an end, a picture of one of the great extinction catastrophes, inert and finished, no drama. Then, one morning, in this nothingness, I found some inhabitants, about 60 dark grey bulbous common winkles, Littorina littorea. They tend, in the first days of spring, to come up from the lower parts of the tide, where they have been sheltering in the winter from the cold. And so they had arrived here now in the pool, another marvel in this shrunken world. These are the edible winkles. Their Latin name means the shorey shore things. Picked in their uncounted millions from these coasts now and exported largely to France. Clumps of the big round bodies of their shells, narrowing at the top to pointed spires, were gathered here and there on the rocks and on the fine mud sand in the centre of the pool. I thought at first they were still, but watching each cluster showed that gently, at about a move a minute, they were jostling and bustling, a slow motion stirring, like a stately and patient dance. It was a Dickensian scene, a social conference, in silence, but with the look, if you could have heard it, of much muttering and murmuring, Stilton and Wensleydale for all comers, no one here without his watch-chain. Winkles have the dignity of corpulence, a cigar in one hand, a glass of port in the other, and I sat in the sunshine counting this happy party of grey-frocked beadles. They are the commonest of things here, and they played their part in the metaphorical life of the people. A miser, it was said, was the sort of man who would count the periwinkles on a rock. Numberlessness was their condition. They became the very bottom layer of life on which the poor could rely. A broth made with them was said to be good for nursing mothers. If strained and drunk, it would mend the gravel and the stone, a form of sympathetic magic. A soup of these pebble-like little creatures, sieved so that only the liquid remained, might, in pure sympathy, ease any stony concretions from the body. James Macpherson, the 18th-century collector, editor and translator of the Songs of Ossian, which he thought fragments of a Gallic epic based in Morven, full of warring, sighing, grieving heroes, calls one beach at which the heroes landed the Traine Fuch, the periwinkled shore. It was a phrase Macpherson's critics thought inconsistent with epic dignity. Would Achilles or Odysseus ever have landed on a shore encrusted with sea snails? But adjust your scale, and the winkles are full of epic dignity. They were now engaged on their various rolling stagecoach journeys across the sand, and they soon dispersed. One, very pale with variegated stripes to its shell, started to make its way slowly eastwards over the sandy floor, its pair of flat antennae feeling the way out before it. As it moved, there was a slow, slight wobbling of the house on its back. The burdened creature was making its way across its world. There was no prawn-like flitting here. The massive shell declared the principle on which the winkle's life is based. Not quickness, but armour, a slow and protected seriousness, which does not leave much room for spontaneity. The prawn may like and need its refuge, in the way of any high-strung flickery thing. But the winkle carries its well-being with it, and no need of a rock under which to hide. Its mode is to trundle. The music of its life is slow and deep. In 5 minutes it moved about 2 inches, leaving its track as a shallow groove behind it in the sand. Only then did I see that the entire floor of the pool was crisscrossed with those tracks, woven in and out of each other, as much as the flight of the martins had made a warp and weft between the trees. Some got all the way to the beach, 3 feet away, where they settled next to a piece of limestone. Others migrated a yard to the various spots on the eastern shales, and one or two, a couple of feet to the northwestern lump of basalt, where they stopped on a patch of old greyish coralline. I made a map of their paths, a joint biography of the winkle's morning since the tide had last been in. Where they crossed the fronds and hanks of kelp that had floated into the pool, they left their tracks on the surface of the weed. It was clear that the marks were more than just the drag of their passage. The winkles had removed the layer of indeterminate stuff that had settled on the kelp, in fact grazing on it, harvesting this scurf known to biologists as biofilm, which is the foundation of life on the shore. Julian Cremona, one of the great coastal biologists of Britain, and for many years head of the Dale Fort Field Centre on the edge of Milford Haven in Pembrokeshire, has described how these biofilms are found on any surface where there is moisture, from swimming pools to the top of a mountain range, from the surface of a moss to the film that covers your teeth before you brush them clean. That clogging tooth film on waking up is the foundation of rock pool life. The wet surface of your teeth, as of these blades of kelp, attracts bacteria which, within minutes, begin to secrete sugary chemicals, the polysaccharides that start to pullulate and fold over on themselves, making a matrix of layers that soon, in Cremona's words, becomes a complex 3D structure of holes and tunnels. This microscopic subworld, with its underpasses and flyovers, refuges and public squares, the thoroughways and piazzas into which life can funnel and crowd, becomes a growing city for all sorts of beings, diatoms and other microalgae that float in their hundreds of millions as plankton in the seawater, strings of connected life, all types of ancient photosynthesizing bacteria, the cyanobacteria, among the oldest of living things on Earth. The enfolding mesh of these new arrivals, suburbs and colonies of vitality, climbing above the original surface, will trap any detritus falling through the water column of the pool, fragmentary pieces of broken or dropped algae from seaweed torn by the waves or eaten by tiny single-celled animals, the protists. Unseen by us, too small for us, but fundamental to the life workings of this place, an entire ecology and economy develops within layers that are no more than a few microns thick. The complexity and local variation is unaddressable. I can see only the periwinkles mowing their swathes through the biofilm, as if through the grass of a field, or more like the earth-moving machines that create new cuttings and embankments for roads and bypasses. They use their radulae, the raking and rasping cheese-grater tongues, fitted with a complex of small and renewable hooks, to file away at the bacterial sludge and at the bodies of the softer green seaweeds, the gutweed and the bright green fronds of the sea lettuce, recycling the nutrients, making them, for a moment, their own. You can see this and watch this and observe the relationship of gastropod to its algal and bacterial food, but the sense of vertigo, of the layers of life disappearing away from sight, down into the tunnels of the microscopic, is inescapable. Every part of the world is an other world. These winkles, like a rock pool, because they can only happily feed when immersed in the seawater and their surroundings are wet. They are able to spend time out of water, stuck to a dry rock with some of their own mucus and with their damp body shut inside the shell with a little carefully fitted lid, an operculum that protects them from desiccation and from predators. But that is unproductive time. The result is that those winkles that are immersed in seawater for only a brief period at the top of the beach must eat their microscopic food more quickly, scraping away at the biofilm with their radulae up to 35 times a minute. Those that live at the bottom of the shore and are immersed for longer can afford to spend their lives chewing away more slowly, the radulae usually harvesting the biofilm at between 5 and 10 times a minute, less than a third of the rate of their cousins at the top of the beach. Why, if life is more difficult here, are there any winkles at the top of the beach? Why are they not all down at the more consistently productive levels, where the world is usually wet, and where temperature, oxygen and salinity are all more constant and more easily dealt with? The answer is the unkindness of strangers, competition from others and the threat from enemies. The lower shore may be richer, but it is more dangerous, filled with rivals and predators. The upper shore is poorer, but it is also safer. Having to eat quickly may be a price worth paying if it is less likely you are going to be eaten in return. The shore is a Darwinian laboratory in which the sculptor of life is the threat of death. These periwinkles, like any other being, are the outcome of an arms race between the ingenuity of their predators, largely crabs but also shorebirds, fish and whelks, and their own defences. An animal's existence is what it can get away with, the room to which their predators are denied access. Sea animals rely on chemical senses to detect their enemies. They know to escape when they get the taste or smell, the two senses are indistinguishable in water, of the predator itself, usually its urine. Some species take this a step further. Minnows, tadpoles, sea urchins, sea anemones, and many sorts of snail, including these periwinkles, are able to tell when one of their own kind is being hurt. They will start to escape as soon as they sense the telltale signals of periwinkle flesh being cut or crushed. In 1980, the distinguished marine scientist Robin P. Hadlock, now based at Cornell University's Shoals Marine Laboratory on the Gulf of Maine, conducted a classic experiment investigating this ability of the winkle to sense trouble. Dr. Hadlock began by crushing some periwinkles and dropping their juice into one or two rock pools on the main coast. The winkles in the pools responded as one might. by moving to sites where they were less visible to a human observer, crawling into crevices in between seaweed fronds or under rocks. As soon as the smell of the juice reached them, the winkles speeded up from about an eighth of an inch a minute to about half an inch a minute, running for the hills. Robin Hadlock then took some winkles to artificial rock pools in her lab and, with considerable sang-froid, watched, step by step, exactly what happened when they met up with a green shore crab, Carcinus minas, the European crab, the commonest crab on British shores and a destructive and invasive introduction to almost every other temperate coastline on Earth. As soon as a crab senses a periwinkle nearby, the pair of short antennae between its eyes start to flicker quickly, apparently searching for the source of the smell, their orientation ranging across the pool in front of it. The maxillipeds, the pair of plates on the underside of the crab in front of its mouth, which are used to shovel food in towards its chewing parts, start to sway from side to side, in a set of movements which look as though the crab is licking its lips. The predator has yet to make its move and may continue like this, quite still, for a few minutes before going into the attack. Only after it has settled on the target does the crab begin to walk towards it. As it approaches the prey, it sweeps its legs and claws across the floor of the pool in a semicircular swiping motion, while the fingers of the claws, the moving parts, open and close in a dactyl snap. What role is played by the theatricality of this crab behaviour, no one has yet established. Once the crab has come into contact with the shell of the winkle, either with its walking leg or its claw, the violence begins. It may simply pull the shell of the winkle from the floor of the pool and bring it to the attack position in front of its mouth, or, more dramatically, the crab can suddenly pounce, using its own body to pin the winkle to the pool floor and then, using its legs, push it forwards towards its mouth. Once the winkle is in position, the crab turns it over with its claws, going quite slowly and delicately pushing the dactyl of its claw into the periwinkle's opening, probing for the flesh of the animal inside. This is an exploratory gesture, perhaps to check that the winkle is worth killing. The crab then removes the dactyl from the opening and starts turning the shell again, stopping occasionally, with one claw around the spire end of the shell and the other holding the bulk of the winkle from below. Death is not long in coming. If the winkle is small, the crab crushes the shell with a claw or breaks off the top of its spire. If the shell is too big to crush, the crab either chips away at the outer lip of the opening until the winkle's little lid is no longer tightly sealed against the shell, and then pushes a claw into the opening where it grabs the body of the winkle. The other claw tugs the shell in the opposite direction, or if the winkle is recalcitrant, continues to chip away at it. The outcome is never that neat, and the crab always has to perform more cracking of the shell before it can get hold of the bulk of its victim's body. Once it has the soft parts exposed, the crab holds the shell up to its mouth with its claws and begins to eat. A small cloud of fluid appears around the mouth parts. Bit by bit, the whole of the winkle is eaten, after which the crab sits quietly and either resumes searching for another winkle or grooms itself, brushing its eyes and antennae of any crumbs that might remain. The dynamics of this terrifying relationship are mysterious at first. Winkles, even with their lives at stake, when they quadruple their usual speed, are not fast movers. A shore crab can easily outrun them. How is it then that any winkle survive the presence of a crab in their pool? It turns out that the timings are critical. Dr. Hadlock found that within about 4 minutes of the crab being placed in the pool, it had located and started attacking any winkles that were stranded out in the open. If they were small, they were crushed and eaten in about 2 minutes 30 seconds, which meant that the crab could quickly move on to another victim. If the next target was a large winkle, more than 3/4 of an inch long, the crab could not usually break its shell, and it would survive the attack. The sheer bulk and shell strength of large individuals is a size refuge. Medium-sized winkles were always eaten, the shell cracked and tissue gradually torn away, but it took time, on average 9 minutes 54 seconds, before the crab had finished with it. Crucially, Hadlock also found that individual winkles alerted by detecting crushed winkle juice in the water and then running for cover took on average about 10 minutes to find a crevice in which they could hide. Once in there, the crab took longer than 16 minutes to discover the winkles and start its attack. It knew winkles were in the pool equally quickly, judging by antennae flicking and maxilliped licking, whether the winkles were in the open or in a crack, but had much more difficulty finding the winkles when they had managed to hide. Even then, the crab found attacking a winkle in a crack with its claws much more difficult and slower. A rock crack is a genuine refuge for a winkle. The implications of this experiment are fascinating. Large winkles are big enough to survive crab attack. Medium and small winkles have no chance once caught. But the ability of the winkle to understand that other winkles in its pool are being attacked is its saving. Small victims serve no purpose to the general population. They are killed and eaten too quickly to make a difference. But in attacking medium-sized winkles, the crab buys the other winkles time to escape and find a refuge. The shells of those medium-sized winkles, in other words, do not protect those individuals, but through the chemical signals their lacerated flesh sends out, the shells do protect the others. In the time the struggle buys the other winkles in the pool, they can escape to hiding places, continue to grow, and eventually develop the thick shells that will protect them in the future. Each winkle population will have multiple victims among the young, a protected older strand of winkles and a band within the population of medium-sized creatures which are effectively killed for the others, a temporal buffer that buys the general population some safety and a continuing life. This biological community structure, which is entirely consistent with Darwinian principles, looks oddly like the roots of something else, the clan civilization of the Highlands. In a pattern shared with many other pre-modern Indo-European societies, from the herder warriors of Central Asia through Homer and the European Bronze Age to the knightly culture of medieval Europe and even to the 19th century rekindling of chivalric ideals, there is a curious continuity with this winkle world. In all of them, young adults suffer so that others do not. Their death guarantees the safety of most. Their resistance is both a communal good and a mere prelude to their own dying. Can it be that a population of winkles, here in this pool, as in all others, has, merely through the forces of natural selection, developed a means of survival that relies on the death of young heroes? Does it mean that Achilles or Oscar, Ossian's son, who in the tales was brought back here to Morven, dead from battle in Ireland, carried on his shield, are nothing but members of a biological category which any population of any animal subject to predation will also have among them? The periwinkle has more secrets to reveal in an environment of more complex interactions. Its preferred seaweed food is soft green algae, such as gutweed. Its Latin name, Ulva intestinalis, tells you what to look for: long strings of intestinal weed, bright green when growing, turning white when dead, and dried in summer. And its cousin, Ulva lactuca, the equally bright green sea lettuce, which has flat lettuce-like leaves. Both of them, at least in sheltered places on the upper shore, will outcompete other seaweeds and, left unchecked, will come to dominate their pools. Further down the shore, where conditions are rougher, they do not survive so well and are outcompeted by the tough brown perennial seaweeds such as bladder wrack and egg wrack, which can take over in summer when the sea lettuce dies back. A beautiful pool on the upper shore full of that greenery will look, or smell, attractive to a winkle, but it will also contain an unpleasant secret. Shore crabs like pools full of gutweed and sea lettuce, because the weed hides them from gull and otter predators. As the marine ecologist Jane Lubchenco revealed in her groundbreaking PhD at Harvard in the 1970s, those three organisms, winkle, crab and green weed, perform their own revolving dance around each other in a set of interlocked and cyclical changes on the upper shore. The first stage in spring is a green pool. The crabs hide in the weed and eat the small, newly metamorphosed periwinkles as they come in from the sea, where the young proto-winkles have floated as plankton, spreading around the shore. The green weed thrives because it has no consumers and it outcompetes other seaweeds. Then the balance changes. Enough periwinkles move in to outlast and outgrow the effects of crab predation, and they begin to make inroads into the gutweed. The more winkles there are, the more the weed shrinks and the less hospitable it becomes for the crabs. Few crabs can survive there now because there is nowhere for them to hide and the gulls take them. All the gutweed in the pool is eaten by the winkles and it becomes dominated by other seaweeds, particularly the hard, scarcely edible pink-encrusting coralline and carrageen, or Irish moss, the beautiful red seaweed whose fronds glitter with the blue shimmer of their reproductive spores. The few winkles that remain survive on small young algae which are eaten as quickly as they sprout. It is a system of exquisite and jewel-like ecologies with two alternative positive feedback loops – green pools remaining filled with green weed, dark red pools with scarcely a sprig of green. You can see this on rocky shores, some pools thickly weedy and green, often when some fresh water gives an advantage to the ulva species, others, usually further down the shore, dominated by the red and brown seaweeds, particularly the carrageen, that can grow only when the green weeds are kept in check by the winkles. Both are stable states, kept going by those two positive feedback loops. Green weeds mean crabs, mean no winkles, mean green weeds. Winkles mean no green weeds, mean no crabs, mean winkles. More recently, Jeffrey Trussell at Northeastern University in Boston has taken those Lubchenco findings and refined them. In the same shallow pools as she studied on the so-called Tide Island of Nahant, east of Boston, it has a narrow spit connecting it to the mainland. Trussell and his co-workers topped up the natural population of periwinkles so that they were at the solid density of 100 winkles per square metre. They also put green crabs into some of the pools, 2 per square metre, which was the natural density. In others, they put the same density of green crabs, but with a difference. These crabs were shut inside perforated plastic tubs that were anchored to the floor of each pool, so that the crabs would not be able to escape and prey on the winkles. From time to time, these imprisoned crabs were fed mussels and winkles. In a third set of pools, equally full of winkles, the biologists made sure there were no crabs at all. Trussell covered each pool in vinyl-coated netting with a 35mm mesh anchored to the rocks around it. The bigger crabs were kept either in or out of the pool by the netting, but the team checked every week that no small crabs had crept in to disrupt the experiment. If they had, they were removed. Importantly, though, the netting allowed light into the pools so that the seaweeds could grow and the mesh was big enough to allow winkles in and out. 6 months passed and the winkles were counted again. Not surprisingly, the number in pools where the crabs had been able to catch and eat them was significantly down, from 100 per square metre at the beginning of the experiment to 71. In the pools where the crabs had been kept in their plastic tubs and had been unable to prey on the winkles, the reduction of winkle numbers was even more severe, no more than 66 per square metre. In those pools where there had been no crabs, tubbed or untubbed, the number of winkles had increased to 159 per square metre. The difference in winkle numbers had a dramatic effect on the seaweeds. The pools that had crabs, either in or out of tubs, had at least 3 times more gutweed than the pools where the winkles had been unthreatened. And so what had happened? It was clear that the winkles did not need to smell crushed or lacerated winkle flesh to start their escape manoeuvres. The mere presence of a crab was enough for them to leave. The gutweed had proliferated because the Winkles had smelt a crab in their pool and got out. Trussell had shown that Lubchenko's conditions were not fixed. A migrating crab can drive Winkles out of a pool and so change its ecology. Its arrival could turn a red pool green through Winkle fear alone. Predation did not need to occur for its effects to be felt. Fear of abuse was as potent a motivator as the abuse itself. The Winkles could understand at a distance when their lives were under threat, act to escape it, and abandon a pool to a new green crab-filled future. Just as easily, though, the Winkles could work on crab fear, turning a green pool red by stripping it of its green weed and exposing the crabs to the threat of gull predation, from which, inevitably, they would also run. There are three sorts of Winkle in this bay: the smooth-shelled grey edible ones, the tiny, beautifully named Littorina neglecta, which lives on the upper shore in cracks and the empty cup cases of barnacles, and their slightly larger cousins, the flat periwinkle called Littorina obtusata, meaning the blunted one, because the twist of its shell does not come to a spired point like the others. The flat periwinkle usually lives a little further down the tide on the fronds of the serrated and bladder rack, and they come in a variety of colours and checkered patterns, often brownish or greenish, but most sparklingly a bright canary primrose yellow, visible 10 yards away on the beach. Why such yellow in this world of browns and greys? It is almost certainly another form of hiding. If you wade out into the shallows and look down onto the serrated rack, bladder rack or grape rack on which these smooth Winkles tend to live, nearly all of them disappear from view. In the shadows and branchings of the weed, with the movement of the sea and the glinting of the light, the little brownish nodules of the Winkles become indistinguishable from the bladders and bumps on the seaweed itself. They are hiding from the birds, or at least the brown ones are. What are radiantly prominent to the eye are the yellow Winkles, sprinkled over the mid-tide landscape like sequins. The answer to this oddity is that not all the Winkles' predators look at them from above. The green shore crabs, like the blennies that also prey on them, are, at least in part, visual predators. From below, in sunlight, the weeds are pale, near yellow, brightly lit, and in those conditions it is the yellow Winkles that are difficult to see. Their brown cousins stand out as all too visible packages of prey. Yellow Littorini obtusati survive by hiding in the light. Not that anything is fixed. A decade after completing her doctorate, Dr. Hadlock, now at Cornell and married to the bee scientist Thomas Seeley, turned her attention to the evolution on the American coast of this little blunt Winkle. Its enemy, the European green shore crab, had arrived north of Cape Cod only in about 1900, but its coming had brought a revolution to the world of the Winkle. Robin Hadlock Seeley measured and analysed all shells of the smooth Winkle that had been collected in New England before 1900, and then measured shells of living populations from the same places. It was clear that the form of the Winkle had entirely changed in the century it had been exposed to the green shore crab. Before 1900, the blunt Winkle in New England was not very blunt at all, with a taller spire and a thinner, more elegant shell than its European equivalents. Smooth Winkles collected at the same places in 1982 to 1984 were shorter, blunter, and with thicker shells. The 100 years it took for the American smooth Winkle to change its form is a blink in geological time. In any fossil record, it would appear as an instantaneous shift from one state to another. A paleontologist would consider this the arrival of a new species. It wasn't, but a measure of flux in the persistence of life, the arrival of a new predator distorting the forms of the biological field around it, in the way that a heavenly body bends and tests the gravitational field through which it passes. The European crab had, in effect, changed its prey into the shape it has in European waters. The Winkles are living in an increasingly hostile world. Everywhere in the North Atlantic, outside Europe, as the Dutch evolutionary biologist Gerard J. Fermé has written, an increase in shell thickness has been taken as a response to the spread of the introduced European green crab, Carcinus minus. But these changes may also have resulted from an overall increase in the abundance of native shell-crushing crabs, cancer species, and lobsters, Homarus americanus, as the predators, including cod, of these crustaceans were overfished. The destruction of the cod and the collapse of their position as an apex predator in the Atlantic has led to a growth in the abundance of shrimps, lobsters and crabs throughout this ocean. It is now a sea of claws. That hugely increased claw count and competition between the clawed animals has risen to the point where the shell dwellers are feeling the pressure and have responded as shell dwellers and shell wearers must, by thickening their defences and toughening their lives. But modern life has provided them with one more hurdle, the acidification of the world ocean. It is recognised now that winkles and other sea snails only need the flavour of a crab in the water around them to react defensively, nor is the reaction a spur-of-the-moment event. Ruth Bibby from the University of Plymouth raised some young periwinkles she had collected from pools on the Devon coast. When the aquarium she grew them in also contained a crab, the periwinkles were enclosed in perforated plastic pots so the crab could not attack them, the periwinkles increased their usual shell thickness by about 30%. Somehow, in ways that are not entirely clear, the young winkles knew their survival depended on thicker shells. The acidification of the ocean plays havoc with this defence mechanism. One third of all the carbon dioxide that has been emitted since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution has been absorbed by seawater, turning it acid. It is still being absorbed at a rate which is about 100 times faster than any period in the last 650,000 years. The way in which animals make their shells and skeletons, drawing calcium carbonate from the water, is more difficult in an acid sea. Shells dissolve in acid. When Ruth Bibby raised the young periwinkles in the presence of a crab, but in seawater that was acidified by bubbling CO2 through it, the shells did not thicken, but remained as thin as those of winkles that had grown up with no crab in their tank. An acid sea will make winkles vulnerable to crab predation, with all kinds of ripple effects spreading from that. More crabs, fewer winkles, denser algae, and a disruption of the entire coastal ecosystem. The effect is more than purely chemical. When sea fish are exposed to acid water, their senses of smell and hearing are both disrupted. Young fish find it more difficult to learn, become less frightened by danger, and are even attracted to the smell of predators. The chemical mechanisms of their nerve systems are in this way fatally disrupted by the acid water. The same effects have recently been found in marine snails such as the winkles. The spectacularly named seaweed-eating conch, the Gibberullus gibberullus gibbosus, and its specialist predator, the cone shell, Conus marmoreus, live in sandy areas around tropical coral reefs. The conches have a special foot and operculum, the hard lid on top of the foot, which they use both to flick themselves upright if they find themselves upside down, and to escape their cone shell predators, which can shoot them with a poisonous dart. Once the conch smells the cone shell in the water, it kicks out and dramatically leaps away from the enemy, the jump usually being about one shell's length away from danger. Sue Ann Watson and her colleagues from James Cook University in Queensland collected conches and their cone shell predators at Lizard Island Lagoon on the Great Barrier Reef, wanting to know what happened to this response if the water was acidified. A single conch was put in an aquarium 10 millimetres in front of a thin transparent plastic barrier. The seawater could flow across the top of the barrier, but it was designed to stop a successful attack if the conch did not manage to escape. A cone shell was put 10 millimetres away from the barrier on the other side. Predator and prey faced each other, and Dr. Watson observed. In normal seawater, 65% of the conches jumped away. In acid water, only 33% jumped at all, taking twice as long to react to the danger, and when they did jump, choosing to leap not so directly away from the cone shell. In nature, without the barrier, most of them would have died. There was no change in the physical jumping ability itself. Even in acidified water, the conches could easily turn themselves upright. What the acid seawater affected, in Dr. Watson's own term, was the decision-making of the conch. The toxic sea was distorting its mind.